what people can do with it and how it's changing our lives. And I think that a lot of that is getting funneled into people like Kevin and people like Bernie. And I think added to that, you have law enforcement who is just, you know, way behind the curve on this stuff and just doesn't know, is not able to separate things, is not, doesn't really know, you know, a modem from a Macintosh. And, you know, this is the result of stuff like this.
Now, you can say that law enforcement is kind of out of the loop on this, but then there are people in computer security, people like Tsutomu Shimomura, people who should know better. What's their excuse?
Well, I mean, I think Tsutomu was genuinely wanted to get Kevin out of his hair, you know, and I don't think that Tsutomu was responsible necessarily personally for the way this thing has been exploited and has been blown way out of proportion. I mean, he did hunt Kevin down, but he's not the one who wrote the New York Times articles, and he's not the one that gave it the front page play, and he's not the one, you know, who whipped up a lot of this hysteria. I mean, he's obviously benefited from it and milked it, but it's larger than just Tsutomu.
Actually, I got to talk to Tsutomu, and I actually have a comment by him. I haven't read the entire book yet, unfortunately, and this one of the sections that I did hear about referred to a local internet provider here in New York, and he actually made some really gross characterizations about it and about people on it. One of the people that he had mentioned that were on it was Fiber Optic, and Fiber has never been on the system ever. So when I got to meet Tsutomu at the book signing, I asked him in front of a crowd of people how he could, you know, go and print something like that and how he can claim his book to be factual when such a detail as this was completely off base. And his answer to me was, oh, well, I didn't actually write that part. One of my aides was the one who researched that and put that part in.
Why is he just blame Andrew Gross again? Because he seems to be responsible for everything that went wrong.
Right, I mean, but that's not the point. I mean, the point is he printed it and his name's on it. And I didn't get a straight answer from Markoff either. I asked him, I said, you know, you're a reporter for some very reputable newspapers. I mean, don't you check your sources? Don't you check your facts before you write the book?
I'd like to add to Jeff said there a moment ago, because I think he's right that John wrote the stories, and that really did whip up the hysteria. But I think the truth is that Shimomura knew somebody was trying to get into his machines early in fall, 2 or 3 months before. And I don't think this was a case where his security was, his fantastic security was broken. I think it's starting to look more and more like there's a strong possibility that was a bait machine. And that Shimomura had a plan to turn this into something that it really wasn't. I think there's a lot of things pointing at
that. Well, there was talk of his machines being broken into the previous summer, and that was not addressed in all of the books. Now, what is
it? Well, it was addressed briefly in mine, as much as I could.
Uh-huh. Well, it certainly wasn't addressed in Takedown, was it?
No. A lot of things weren't addressed in Takedown.
Yeah, that's one of the things the most frustrating things about that book to me is that there's so much about that story that they both know and didn't print. I mean, you know, they just start it from the date of the break-in, and they don't go into any of the history of Tsutomu's relationship with Mitnick and Markov's relationship.
We have Fiber Optic joining us now.
I have a question which no one seems to be able to answer, which has been puzzling me since this whole thing began. And that question is, if Shimomura is such an expert security dude, then how come he was trusting John Gilmore's machine, Toad.com?
Well, I addressed that in my story, and obviously if he disabled the ARC commands, this attack would have been impossible. And he knew he'd been poked at, and he'd been successfully attacked the summer before, and the NSA had been upset about it, and he didn't take that step. And that's why you start to wonder, maybe he didn't want his machine to be secure.
Well, I mean, that's like rule number one. Well, I guess it's rule number two, right after choosing a good password. But that second rule is never trust anybody else's host. It's ridiculous.
Exactly. And there, as we know, there are tens of thousands of machines that don't trust other hosts. So that meant, on that day, contrary to what the New York Times and Markoff reported in the New York Times, there were tens of thousands of people who had better security than Tsutomu Shimomura.
Well, he clearly was interested in you know, setting some bait to trap to trap Kevin. I mean, there's no question that that was sort of on his mind. Just based on the conversations I had with people at the Supercomputer Center about some of the other plans that they had prior to that, doing a kind of cuckoo's egg kind of ploy, which they decided to abandon at the last minute. But.
Well, it was a matter of honor. That's something that was brought up many, many times, that he had to right this wrong that was committed against him. And I think maybe in the process, don't you think maybe he lost sight of what it was he was actually doing by writing
the
song?
That's one of the big Wild West stereotypes that was given to this, that he was the guy on the white horse, and Mitnick was the guy with a black hat. And as we know, Shimomura associates with hackers who also inhabit this sort of gray area. He helped to develop some cellular software that is considered to be generally hacker cellular software. He also wrote this Berkeley packet filter program. He modified it. And as Gilmore has recently alleged in a post to Cypherpunks, you know, that could have been a far more dangerous thing than anything Mitnick ever did or might have done.
Well, I know this, that if I knew of something like that that was in existence, something that that could be used for all kinds of evil purposes, I'd at least want to find out if it really existed. Is that something that's so bad to actually want to see if something evil is being developed?
No. The question that Gilmore has raised is that he helped develop the Berkeley packet filter, which is, in Gilmore's words, a dangerous, actually he says it's an evil program. And it was on his machine, and he has claimed that that was one of the things that was taken by whoever broke into his machine, and we don't know for certain that Kevin Mitnick broke in. And the question that Gilmore has sort of raised is, if he was writing this dangerous program, and it was for the NSA, the intelligence agency, why was it on his machine if he didn't want to protect his machine? And I think it's a good point. Unfortunately, Mr. Shimomura isn't taking any questions.
That's interesting, too, because we contacted Shimomura. We sent him mail after John Markoff canceled and asked him if he would want to be on the show. I expected to be rejected. I didn't expect not to get any reply whatsoever. We also asked Andrew Gross, his beleaguered assistant, and at least he had the good grace to contact us and say that he couldn't do it. So, unfortunately, I really wanted this program to be a rousing debate between the different sides, but the folks from Takedown weren't up to it, I guess. I could not get anybody.
Well, they got a lot of bad press recently. The New Yorker last week had a really devastating article written by Mr. Wright. It's Hacker versus Hacker. Folks have seen that. It was a January 29 issue. And it really... I think follows on a line that I wrote about and that Jeff wrote
about.
Okay,
we're about to lose Bernie. Yes, Bernie, there's a lot of noise coming from the prison there, so we're going to have to drop you this time.
That's okay.
All right, but keep in touch. Give us a call. By the way, your packages are not going through. They're being rejected, so find out about that.
All right. I'll call you tomorrow about that.
Yeah, they say they won't accept packages for you, so please get back to us on that.
I'll do that.
All right, good luck to you.
Good luck with the fundraising drive.
Thanks a lot. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
That's Bernie S. talking to us from prison over there in Easton, Pennsylvania. And I was there for only a few minutes. I tried to visit, actually, but they wouldn't allow that. And the place is living hell. You have people now, you know, who are guilty of nothing so much as curiosity. In fact, Bernie had to apologize before the court for his odd curiosity, in quotes. That's and it was so sad watching this, seeing this guy who I know, who everybody that is friends with him knows, didn't do anything. I mean, you know, Kevin Mitnick is you know, Al Capone compared to this guy, and I don't even think Kevin Mitnick belongs in prison. But he has not even been accused of doing anything yet. He is forced to spend time with murderers. I mean, murderers, rapists, the most evil people that there are, you know, his companions right now. And this is what the Secret Service says is okay. Let me ask you two as authors, does something seem inherently wrong with this? Why are not more people talking about it?
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, they just don't know how to talk about it. I mean, it's, you know, it's just something that they see as something that they don't understand, that is far off. I think it's, people are talking about it more and more. I mean, now look, with what happened with Kevin, we have three books coming, you know, that are out about it. We have, You know, before, in 1988, when Kevin was arrested, journalists were able to get away with, you know, writing more or less whatever they wanted about him because there were very few people writing about it in those days. Now we have a lot, it's much more in the consciousness, and there's many more people writing about it. It's much more difficult to get away with things, and I think that's all to the good. I think that the more the people who write about it, the more debate there is, the more public discussion, the more we bring it into the public eye, the less likely it is that things like this will happen.
You see,
I agree with Jeff completely. I think the fact that both Jeff and I have been able to write books about this from different perspectives, and hopefully we've both, you know, added something to the debate, and it's not just us. There have been, as I mentioned, the New Yorker had a great piece. The Nation, when this first broke last year, wrote a piece very critical of actually John Markoff. And so I think what happened, as often happens, it was sort of a one-source story when it first came out. It was John Markoff and Tsutomu Shimomura. And because the New York Times is so powerful, a lot of the stories really imitated or simply ran verbatim the New York Times. And fortunately, for folks out there who like a different perspective, there now are, you know, two other books which I think really have more of the true story than the, quote, official New York Times version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you do raise a very valid point there, because I remember the frustration when the Mitnick story was first breaking. Everybody was saying the same thing. Everybody was saying he was guilty of this, guilty of that. Nobody was listening to the actual facts. And I remember being the lone voice on the well during their various conferences on the subject, saying, you know, guys, read between the lines here. This can't necessarily be true. You have to question things. And now we see two books, at least, that are critical of this, magazine articles, a lot of people questioning what really happened. And I think that's healthy.
And, you know, Emmanuel, the net played actually a big part in this, because you and many other people knew some of these facts. You and other people knew that, for instance, there'd never really been any evidence that Kevin Mitnick was responsible for war games, or that he had done the infamous NORAD hack quite some time ago. And, of course, the lead item in the New York Times that he had 20,000 credit card numbers, you and other people knew that this was overblown, and those things sort of got out on the net, and journalists started to pick them up. And I think it's taken a little while, but I think the truth is starting to come through.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big themes in this is not just, you know, what happened with Kevin, but also the way journalism is changing and the way the media is changing. I mean, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, a book like Takedown would have been written, and there would have been no forums for people to debate it, to hold the writer and Tsutomu accountable and ask them questions, as people have been trying to do now. And now we see, even as the authors are out on the tour, them being pummeled by questions right and left. All that, they can't go anywhere without having these questions raised. And I think that that's a healthy thing. I just think that's a healthy
thing. It is. But you know, the thing that keeps striking me is that these folks have gone out, they've written their story, they're millionaires now, while Kevin is still in prison, you know, with nothing to look forward to.
Yeah,
that
you're
bothers
right.
me. That really bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something very wrong that happened here, because I think in two levels. One, there's a person involved, and, you know, whether you like Mitnick or not, whether you think he's a criminal or not, nobody should be used, you know, for publicity in an article. But I think also on another level, besides the human level, we all were sort of used, because the hype gave the perception that, you know, the sky was falling in, that the internet was suddenly terribly vulnerable. And, of course, the reality was the internet had always been vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really a manufactured story. And it really, unfortunately, gave a lot of impetus for those people who want more law enforcement, more monitoring, you know, really more Big Brother on the net. And I think Kevin Mitnick lost in a very human way. And I think we all lost in the beginning there, because the debate was focused because of that false impression.
I'd like to, at this point, read something from the John Lipman book, The Fugitive Game, Online with Kevin Mitnick, that might bring this forth in a better way, I guess. I've had to substitute some of the words because of the FCC, but I think the overall effect of this won't be lost. Jonathan Lippman was, of course, receiving phone calls from Kevin Mitnick. He was actually in touch with him and right up until the very end. And this is the a bit of a transcript from one of those phone calls from Kevin. I'm not going to be able to call you anymore, but I wanted to tell you something first. It's nearly 9 on Friday night, just hours since America's most wanted computer criminal checked in to laugh about Shimomura being hacked. But now Mitnick's agitated. Something's up. I've never heard him talk this way before. I just saw this movie, Murder in the First. It's about this guy that stole $5 and they put him in Alcatraz for 5 years and started beating him. Finally, he went nuts and killed somebody. It's with Christian Slater. It parallels my case. Here I am, a computer hacker. Not that I ever went to Alcatraz, but at MDC they put me in this room with a dim light, a bed, and a toilet, 6 by 9 foot. They let me out 45 minutes a day for fresh air. The rest of the day I was in the part where they send you if you've assaulted a prisoner or killed somebody. Legally, you're not supposed to be there more than a certain number of days. They do it to me for 8 months. I wonder if that has anything to do with how I think about them. I was in this freaking room for 8 months. They used the telephone as an excuse. We can't let him near a phone. He might launch missiles. I was in there 8 freaking months, Mitnick shouts indignantly. I don't think you can comprehend. Go into your bathroom and put on a 50-watt bulb. Try to stay there an hour. Mitnick describes the daily rituals of his imprisonment. They'd shackle my legs and arms. Two guards would escort me, unshackle me, and let me shower. A minute shower. Then shackle me back and take me back to the cell. I can see it for a few days, but 8 months? Go into the bathroom and put up a 50-watt bulb and see if you go stir-crazy. Lippman asks, what time of the day did you go outside for the 45 minutes? Whenever the guard wanted. It was like a big patio all caged in. 8 north, up on the 8th floor. One time they put me up with one of these Cuban guys. I say, why are you in the hold area? He said, I have a 3-man hold order. They can't move me without 3 officers. I killed 2 officers already. Mitnick yells, they put me with this Cuban who killed guys. What the hell are they doing that for? Locking me up with that guy. This guy, who knows, maybe he'll kill somebody for kicks. It was torture. You're just in there with yourself. I mean, you're locked in your cell 23 out of 24 hours. That's the worst punishment they could do. It was torture, man. It was hard to describe. I mean, here it is. What is it, 6, 7 years later, and I'm still pissed. Lippman asks, was there ever anybody else you talked to about this? Kevin, I never talk to anybody about it. They don't give a crap. They say, oh, it's over. But it's mental goddamn torture, and I'll never forgive the U.S. government for it, ever. I'm not saying that I'm going to get even or something like that, so don't read that into it, but I'll never forgive them for that crap. It was the judge's order. My attorney brought it up to the judge on several occasions in court. And know what her comment was? This is where he belongs. And this is one of the most liberal judges in the L.A. area, right? That's where he belongs. I remember those words exactly. It's like, you know, they show me no mercy, so why should I show them any? No mercy, man. Later, I phoned the Metropolitan Detention Center in Los Angeles, the federal jail where Mitnick did 8 months of solitary, to check out his story. There's very limited information that we would have, the warden's executive assistant tells me, suggesting I call Lompoc. If the inmate had a discipline problem, all that information would be contained in the central file. Officials at Lompoc are also of little help, except to explain that, as far as the Federal Bureau of Prisons is concerned, lockdown or solitary confinement doesn't exist. The terms we use in the Federal Bureau of Prisons are administrative detention and disciplinary segregation. Finally, I find someone at the Washington, D.C. office of the FBP. I spell Mitnick's name, and she brings up his file on the Bureau's computer system. Oh, there he is. His registrar number was 89950-012. He came to Terminal Island as a pre-sentencing admission on December 9, 1988. Then he was transferred to MDC LA on December 12, 1988 and remained there as a holdover until August 12, 1989. Was he in administrative detention? No, answers the official definitively. He was on a regular unit. I was told he didn't receive the same treatment as other inmates. It doesn't look that way. There was only one episode, but if that's the reason why he was there or in any kind of different housing, you're going to have to go through Freedom of Information Act for that, because I couldn't tell you that if I wanted to. But she tells me anyway. It looks like he was just in regular units except for maybe 2 weeks. That's about it, from April 26th, 89 till May 10th. That was the only case where there was anything special about his housing. The rest of the time, it looks like he was just in regular units. Interesting. As far as the Federal Bureau of Prisons computers are concerned, Kevin Mitnick's 8 months of solitary confinement was only a 2 week stint. But in fact, Kevin Mitnick's version is true. Newspaper articles, one book, Mitnick's attorney, and statements by the judge in his case confirm that indeed, the hacker was held in solitary confinement for the bulk of his incarceration. John Lipman, that's powerful stuff there.
Well, you know, and the amazing thing is that a lot of other journalists have simply written that he was in Lompoc during this time. Of course, Lompoc is a farm, and it's very casual. It's where they send folks like Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken. And, you know, Kevin had ordinary attorneys. He couldn't afford, you know, the million-dollar attorneys, and so he got average justice, which in America, if they decide you are a dangerous criminal, isn't much fun. I think when you see what happened to Mitnick, you realize that he was punished for what they feared he could do. You know, the judge really had, there were all sorts of claims about how he messed with TRW reports and messed with probation officers, and there was no proof of these things. The case that he was in there for was a DEC case, Digital Equipment Corporation case. The government claimed $4 million of damages. When they finally entered a plea, it had been reduced to $160,000. Typically, the $4 million figure was used for years by a number of reporters, even though it had been even thrown out by the government. So, it's not clear that this has changed at all in his current case. David Schindler is the U.S. attorney in Los Angeles who's prosecuting his case right now. From all I can tell, Schindler wants 8 years for Mitnick, which is about what you get for manslaughter.
Unbelievable. We're talking with Jonathan Lipman, who is the author of one of the Kevin Mitnick books, The Fugitive Game. We're also speaking with Jeff Goodell, who wrote The Cyber Thief and the Samurai, a book which is, I believe, it's a Dell paperback. Is that correct?
Right.
And that will be coming out next month?
It should be in the store at the end of this week.
The end of this week. Okay. And that's quite a fascinating read as well. Jeff's book is a bit more, I guess, kind of like a timeline sort of a thing. There's plenty of insight in there, but I see less of the actual questioning of Markov and more kind of getting to the root of what Kevin is where he is coming from. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think I question Markov plenty. I mean, I think that I don't think that Markov, you know, is I don't think this was a premeditated plot to sell a book to make $2 million or whatever the final number was. I don't think that's true. I think that he, you know, made some judgment calls in the reporting of this story that I would question and a lot of other people would question. But, you know, I don't see him I just don't see this as something that it was plotted for a long time. I have a hard time getting, I think that Markov was clearly the instrument by which Kevin was demonized for a lot of his misdeeds. But I just think that a lot of it was just a kind of institutional arrogance that is bred among the New York Times reporters to paint things in black and white this way. I mean, we saw this story hyped as well as it would have been hyped on Geraldo. I mean, there was sort of no subtlety at all. It was just the institutional point of view with complete disregard for the human being.
And the authors of the other book are not represented, unfortunately, on this radio program, that book being Takedown, The Pursuit and Capture of Kevin Mitnick's America's Most Wanted Computer Outlaw by the Man Who Did It, Tsutomu Shimomura, with John Markov. We'll be getting back into our discussion in just a moment, but first I'd like to take some time out to encourage people to call in. We have a special deal on this special Kevin Mitnick night of Off the Hook. And it involves all three of these books, actually. So if you are interested in the story, and I think many, many people out there are, this is the perfect opportunity to learn, I guess, from all different sides to get as thorough a story as you possibly can. All right, here's the deal. 212-279-3400 is our phone number. Now, we have what is known as a 2600 package. That includes a subscription to 2600 Magazine, where the Hacker Quarterly, Kevin Mitnick, has contributed to this magazine. We've covered the Mitnick instances over the years, and as well as many other hacker news items. Most recently, we have some information from America Online that some might consider to be a bit shocking and controversial. That's in the current issue of 2600. You'll get a subscription to 2600 as well as a copy of The Fugitive Game by John Lipman, and that's for a pledge of $150. That's right, 212-279-3400. Call in for that particular deal, the 2600 package, a one-year subscription to the magazine, and a copy of The Fugitive Game. We also have the special Off the Hook Gold package. Yes, the Gold package. All three books, The Fugitive Game, Takedown, and The Cyber Thief and the Samurai. More Mitnick news than you could possibly imagine, and you'll get it all for $150 as well. So, 212-279-3400. Please show your support for this radio station. Light up our phone lines. We're only up to $850 for this program. We really should be far beyond that. And the reason we're kind of behind is because we've been spending so much time talking about the issues. We'd like to get back to the issues. We'd like to talk about this some more. We're on until 10 o'clock. And we'd like to spend as much time as possible discussing what we consider to be timely news items. 212-279-3400. We have all three books, The Fugitive Game, Takedown, and The Cyber Thief and the Samurai, as premiums here at the radio station, our way of showing thanks for your support of freedom of speech. And you know, you may have seen a lot of coverage of the Takedown tour. This occurred everywhere. I saw Tsutomu Shimomura on CNN. I heard him on WNYC. He was all over the place. I haven't seen as much coverage for the other two books, and I think that's unfortunate because I think they're the ones that really raise a lot of the questions that the other book kind of chose to ignore.
Well, Emmanuel, I'd like to say that, first off, it's actually not quite right. I think Jeff and I, both of our books, are starting to get lots of attention. You know, I mentioned I was lucky to be on CNN yesterday. This New Yorker story is about my book and Takedown, and the New Yorker has just blasted Takedown, and I know Jeff got a very good review in Entertainment Weekly. Jeff,
yeah,
and you know, the print really has a lot. Print and radio have a lot more to do with you know, why people buy books. And it's true that Tsutomu has been on TV because he's got long hair and, you know, he looks hot and exciting. But I think the reality is, both Jeff and I, both of our books are getting a lot of attention in the print media. And I know, actually, I'll give myself a little plug out here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We got on the local bestseller list, and that other book that I don't have to mention with Mr. Shimomura was not on the list. So I think that there's been a lot of, you know, TV attention to Takedown, but I think the fact is, I think a lot of people are more interested in Mitnick, and I think my book, The Fugitive Game, and Jeff's, you know, The Cyber Thief and The Samurai, really talk more about Mitnick, and when you get down to it, that's what this story really was about.
212-279-3400. We only have one call on the line, so we need to bring that up significantly before we can go back to the actual lively discussion we're having about Kevin Mitnick and the several books that have appeared and perhaps films that will be appearing in the future. Please take advantage of this offer. This is a one-time deal here. We were offering all three of these books to you as premiums, as our way of saying thanks for subscribing to WBAI. And, of course, you can pledge any amount that you wish and still be a supporter of WBAI. We have two calls on the line now. You know, we have this neat gadget that is brand new here that shows you how many phone lines are coming in. We have more phone lines than we ever had before. Unfortunately, most of the little dots on that thing aren't lit up red like they should be. Okay, three of them are lit up now. Let's see if we can get a whole lot of them lit up because I kind of like to see how it works. I've never seen this work before. 212-279-3400 for $150. You can either get all three books or a package of 2600 magazine and the Fugitive Game. I don't really know why the Fugitive Game was the one that wound up with 2600. It wasn't my decision. Let me just tell you that right now, so there's no hard feelings here. You can be, I guess, the most educated person on your block about Kevin Mitnick and about all the different things that have gone on in cyberspace. It's, you know, it's not really hopping on the bandwagon to be reading up on this. It is a very interesting story. It's something that we should be questioning, something we should be talking to each other about. Is this a proper way of treating people who are logging into computers they shouldn't log into? I think reading all three books, which is something I've done in the past 2 weeks, really gets your mind full of a lot of the issues. And I would suggest everybody, whether or not they subscribe to WBAI at this point, everybody should read these books and find out what the facts are, because these instances are going to wind up affecting us many years down the road. You know, everybody, not just people on computers. Am I right, John, Jeff?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things here, of course, is that Shimomura, of course, is the fellow who helped to capture Mitnick, and it's clear he didn't have a lot of respect for normal law and order. It's clear that, I know in my book, and I know in Jeff's book, we documented, and in fact in Takedown also, he misled the FBI, he had his own agenda. He said to some, there was a woman at the well who wanted to, enforce the privacy of its subscribers. He said he'd like to get a big rock and do something with that big rock and this woman. So you had a guy who really is kind of a vigilante and seems to have his own agenda. And I think that raises a lot of questions, and we might get excited by this capture, and it certainly was an exciting story. But I don't think we want people like Shimomura becoming sort of the cyber cops.
I don't think we want really cyber cops of any sort, whether they're the Guardian Angels or Shimomura or any one of us. It's kind of a scary thought to think that people are looking over our shoulder and watching what we do and judging it. 212-279-3400. We're in the middle of a pledge drive, and we need your support. Voice your support for this kind of talk, for this kind of discussion, and for this radio station, for this program. You supported us in the past, and we need to hear from you now in order to continue in the future. 212-279-3400. This is the only night that Off the Hook will be on during the fundraiser. So it's now or never, basically. That's what we want to hear from. That's why we want to hear from you folks. 212-279-3400. Here's a quote from Jeff Gerdell's book, The Cyber Thief and the Samurai. We're talking about Kevin Mitnick. He was not Jeffrey Dahmer. He did not kill people and eat them. He was not a serial rapist or a terrorist bomber or a preacher of hate. And he was not Ivan Bosky or a Michael Milken, men who reaped billions with questionable trading practices on Wall Street. By all accounts, Kevin wasn't profiting from his escapades. He wasn't interested in destabilizing the U.S. economy or delivering secret military documents to Saddam Hussein. What he wanted, among other things, was the cellular phone source code that would allow him to hack cellular phones. A crime? Yes. But did that make him a menace to society? Hardly. In fact, Kevin's boldest move, and his stupidest, was to make an enemy out of John Markoff, the one man with the means to put him on the front page of the most powerful newspaper in America.
That passage is referring to Kevin's reappearance last July 4th, 1995. On the front page of the New York Times, which was a very mysterious story. John and I both wrote about it in our piece because Markoff sort of plucked him plucked Kevin Mitnick out of nowhere. There was really no news. It just said that he had been on the, that the FBI hadn't been able to catch him because he had been on the run for a year or so. But there was no real news there, and it was a very peculiar story that I have still not quite been able to make sense of.
Well, and Jeff, there was a couple of strange things that were happening. You don't know if this had anything to do with it, but John Markoff had a movie option, and it was elapsing at that very time. And Mitnick told me about it, and told me that they wanted to extend the option for free. He'd been paid some money, as had Markoff, for a movie option from an earlier book that Markoff had written. And you don't know if that had anything to do with it, but again, I think you're perfectly right. There, not only was there no news, but in that story, he was unable to get one quote from one current law enforcement official saying anything about Mitnick. Saying that he was dangerous, saying that he'd done something, saying that they believed he'd done something. So, you know, in a sense, it was a one-source story. It was John Markoff.
And right? A lot of us were questioning that from the start when we saw that front-page New York Times picture of somebody who's on the run, and what's he accused of? You know, he's not accused of anything violent, not accused of stealing anything.
I mean, he was on the run from probation violation, for Christ's sake. I mean,
yeah, and you know, Mitnick himself...
How many people in America have split from their probation? I mean, come on.
Yeah, there actually are thousands and thousands of people who do that, who are on, you know, the run from their probation at any one time. It's by no means, you know, a most wanted situation. And Mitnick... believed he'd served his probation. There was even debate about that. So you just start to wonder.
Uh-huh. Joker, you have something?
Yeah, I have a question for both the authors. Having spoken to Shima Moore, who actually I think looks like one of the elves in Dark Crystal, but that's just a personal observation. I noticed, Jeff, on the cover of your book, you say the true story of Kevin Mitnick. And having, you know, already stated that I've asked Shima Moore about certain facts in his book, which he admitted to not putting in himself and yet publishing, even though they were unfactual, including some of the information about, hypothetically, the credit cards, you know, being stolen by Kevin, which everybody and their grandmother knows was, you know, released a year previous to that. What did you gentlemen do to keep the books as factual as possible? I mean, you're putting out a book that obviously seems to have some good intent behind it, but obviously, you know, the purpose in putting out a book sometimes is to make money.
Well, I think Jeff and I both had a challenge in that we both had good sources, and I think we both tried to do the best research we could in a short period of time. But I know in my case, for instance, I tried to interview Shima Moore and Markoff, and what happened was an attorney called me, and he said that he was an attorney, but he wasn't working as an attorney. He said he was working for Shima Moore, and he was his friend. And I started to wonder about this guy, and it turns out he made $250 an hour, but he wasn't charging. And I tried to get an interview with these guys. It was didn't look like anything was going to happen. I finally sent 51 questions, and about 6 weeks later, I got an answer after my galleys had been done. So basically the book was all finished. I got a strange letter from Markoff, purportedly on behalf of both of them, which didn't answer about 48 of the 51 questions and obfuscated on other questions. And so I, you know, I figured I ran the letter in the end of my book. And then the next time I heard from them, they both threatened to actually sue me through this same attorney, and I had lots of letters from this same attorney who suddenly worked for both of them, which I found kind of interesting. And that was my experience in trying to get to the bottom of some of these things, and I know Jeff had a colorful experience as well.
You had to actually go skiing with him in order to talk to him.
Yeah, I was working on a story for Rolling Stone, which is this book. I did a piece for Rolling Stone, which this book was what the basis for this book. And Sotomo was very elusive with me, but he was clearly attracted to the idea of of getting a little more publicity. This was just after a couple of weeks after the arrest, and I think they liked the idea of a Rolling Stone piece and of getting a little primer action for their book, stoked the interest a little bit more. But he was very strange and elusive, and if you read my book, the last part of my book is about my trying to track him down through a snowstorm in the Sierras, and what a wild, crazy thing that was. But about the accuracy of these books, I mean, all three of these books were written under real pressure. We had a very short time to do it for as long of books as they are, and I'm sure that all three books have lots of little factual errors that anyone could point to. But I think the big question is a question of faith, of good faith. I think that from my reading of the two books, John and I did our best to tell the story as truthfully as we could from our point of view. I think that the questions that are raised with Takedown is that there's obviously a very deliberate limiting of the perspective of the story. It's very limited. It doesn't tell you a lot of the backstory that everyone knows, that Sutomo and Markov were aware of, and it really does its best to try to pitch this as a black and white story of a good guy and a bad guy that is, if you read the book, it's like, you know, it's written as a movie script. It starts with a, you know, opening love scene in a hot tub.
Yeah, I was able to ask Markov about it. I went up to him and I said, what's the movie called? And he looked at me and laughed and said, we don't have a title yet.
I heard the working title.
The ironic thing is it may have been intended to be a movie script, but boy, when you read The New Yorker, it has gone over as a bomb. Its best chances is a, you know, B-slasher movie at this point. I mean,
yeah, the other
a lot of people have made fun of Tsutomu's hot tub scenes. And,
yes.
And actually, here's one of the twists. When you look at the facts, and Jeff, I think Jeff's made a good point, is that we both did our best, and neither of us, I know I'm not perfect. You know, you can't get every single thing exactly right. But there's some strange things in that other book, and that is, in the New York Times, when this famous Christmas attack took place, Tsutomu Shimomura was up on his way to go skiing in the Sierra Nevada. In their book, on Christmas Eve, he's in the hot tub, and on Christmas, he's right where the attack is being rooted, in bed, supposedly with somebody else's girlfriend. And they never sort of explained how facts like this change so dramatically. The New York Times gave the impression he was a long way from his computers or where the attack was taking place, and we find out in their story he was sitting right on top of it, you know, in a hot tub or in bed, you know, not minding the store.
Yeah.
That is interesting, and at least one reporter actually went so far as to accuse him of setting it up himself.
Right. Right. The San Jose Mercury, right?
Well, I think there is a funny coincidence, and the New Yorker actually points it out. Shimomura has never commented on this bizarre coincidence. You know, the attack took advantage of a trusted machine. It's funny, you know, there's a man-machine irony here. Mitnick took advantage of a trusted machine. Shimomura was taking advantage of a trusted friend of his to make a romantic move toward his girlfriend. This was all happening at the same place. He happened to be at the house where the attack was being rooted, and it is a strange coincidence. And again, it really wasn't addressed in their story.
212-279-3400 is our phone number, and we really need to have some more calls come in. We're up to $1,225 for the show, which is okay, but it's not really where we should be at this point in time. So please give us a call, 212-279-3400. We're offering all three of the Kevin Mitnick books as an offer to people calling in to pledge. 212-279-3400, a pledge of $150 will get you all three of those books, and plus you'll be a member of WBAI. You'll receive the program guide every month, so you'll know what kinds of programs are coming your way. Also, for a pledge of $150, you can get a subscription to 2600 Magazine, The Hacker Quarterly, and a copy of one of the books, The Fugitive Game by John Lipman. All three of these books, though, are very interesting, very compelling reading, very controversial because of the issues of the day. We were talking about reporters getting it right, not getting it right, and I think, Jeff, you should be commended on what you write in your book, one particular instance where you refer to a Rolling Stone article. In my article about Kevin and Rolling Stone, which was written shortly after he was arrested in 1995, I trusted Markoff's reporting and, after checking with Rhodes, decided to include the fact that Kevin had broken into NORAD in my article. I now believe that it's probably a myth and regret having included it. I think it takes a lot to admit something like that and to say that journalists don't always get the story right.
Well, I think that's our job. I mean, we journalists is a very fraught thing to do. I mean, we're constantly making judgments about people. We're constantly interpreting the world for others to read, and people trust us a lot. And I think that it's very important to, when you get things wrong, to admit it and to be straightforward about it. I don't do anything. I felt very bad about that, but I did my best. And you know, when, as soon as I found out otherwise, I admitted it. And I think that's an important thing to do. I think if you can't trust the journalist, then you know, it changes everything.
Uh-huh. I really wish John Markoff was here, because there's so many questions I want to ask him concerning just that issue. I have respect for him as a journalist. He's on top of a lot of stories. But there are these nagging questions concerning his whole role in the Kevin Mitnick saga, his taking part in the tracking down. I mean, there are a couple of things, actually, that bug me personally, because as was mentioned in all three books, it was my conversation with Kevin Mitnick that they were listening in on, and they were running around in their Geo Metros trying to track him down.
Well, yeah, you know, Emmanuel, that's an amazing point you bring up there. To give listeners the whole sequence here, what happened was Shima Moore first went to Raleigh, North Carolina, and then none of us have been able to learn definitively who invited him to North Carolina, because he really wasn't needed there. He didn't even know how to use something called a cell scope, which is to track, you know, the cellular transmissions. He had no technical expertise in that. So he really, there was no purpose for him being there. I suspect one of the U.S. attorneys wanted some publicity out of this and wanted him there, and it was sort of a trade-off. But he showed up the evening of Sunday, the 12th, actually, of February, and a few hours later, John Markoff showed up. And, again, it's not clear who invited him, because the FBI certainly wouldn't have wanted him there. But he showed up, and what happened, which is quite extraordinary, is that at some point they actually moved the cell scope equipment to track Kevin Mitnick into John Markoff's car. Now, when I wrote that in the galley of my book, and when Markoff got a copy of the galley of my book, his attorney claimed that was false, and it never happened, and he threatened to sue me over that. And I had interviewed the cellular technician who had the previous car. I interviewed him several times, and Markoff denied this, and so in my book I gave him you know, his denial, but I continued with my story and said he denies this happened. Well, I was very interested to get Jeff's book, because Jeff had the same story, and Jeff had obviously talked to some other folks, and he had the same story, that the equipment was moved to Markoff's car, and they were tracking in Markoff's car. And you don't normally think a car rented for the New York Times is going to be used in a law enforcement investigation.
That's a very disturbing thing to raise, and something that I think deserves to be debated as to just what his role in this whole tracking incident was. But, you know, speaking as someone who was personally affected by this, I'm always aware that cellular phone calls are able to be listened in on. I mean, I'm demonstrating that for people a lot. But for my conversation with somebody to be used as a way of tracking down that person by people who aren't law enforcement agents in the first place, I don't know, at least with kind of a funny feeling, you know?
Well, I think the funny feeling's correct in that one could argue that Shima Moore could have been working, obviously, for the FBI or the Sprint cellular folks. But Markoff, you can't use that. And so he'd gotten himself into an awkward situation. And, of course, journalists are supposed to scoop the story. But he was so far ahead in some ways of the story that he got himself in some tricky positions where he, you know, he was actually listening to your phone call. And the way I had it, he helped identify both you and Kevin Mitnick. So he's playing an integral role. He's intercepting a call. He's not authorized. He's not allowed to listen to it. And I think these things are good questions, and they need to be debated.
212-279-3400 is our phone number. We're getting a few calls, but we need to get a lot more. So people, please, if you want to see conversations like this in the future, if you want to be a part of these kinds of discussions. I mean, we're talking about, you know, we're the players in this. We're the authors of the books. We're the people who are part of the investigations. We have people in this room that have been prosecuted before in ways similar to Kevin Mitnick. But, you know, there aren't very many places where you can hear their stories firsthand. This is really the only place that you can hear that. That's why we need to get a strong showing today. 212-279-3400. Again, we're offering all three Kevin Mitnick books. And this is the only time this offer will be made on this station. And that's for a pledge of $150. Now, remember, we take credit cards. We take Visa. We take MasterCard. We even take American Express. So you can spread it out over however long you want to spread it out for. And that will get you all three of the books: The Controversial Takedown by Tsutomu Shimomura with John Markoff. You can read their story from their point of view, because unfortunately you can't hear their point of view tonight on the radio. We tried to get them, but they canceled on us. You can read Jonathan Lippman's The Fugitive Game, online with Kevin Mitnick, the inside story of the great cyber chase, and also The Cyber Thief and the Samurai, the true story of Kevin Mitnick and the man who hunted him down by Jeff Goodell. All three of those books for a pledge of $150. 212-279-3400. We have no phone calls on the line, zero phone calls. And, you know, I'd like to do a little better than that, because we have the capacity to take something like 20 phone calls now. You know, we expanded our phone line so we can take more pledges at once. And we have a room filled with volunteers, people that simply want to take your pledge, and that's why they're here. And if they don't do that, they're going to be very upset and, you know, frustrated, and they'll feel their lives are not worth anything. And that's not even starting to get into how I feel if nobody calls. 212-279-3400. We have two phone calls on the line. We need to raise that to let's say, you know, something ambitious, like 10 times that amount. Because if we do that, then we're that much closer to our goal. Our ultimate goal, believe it or not, is $1 million for this pledge drive. $1 million. And we're almost there. 212-279-3400. 212-279-3400. Again, all three books for a pledge of $150. And you can also get a subscription to 2600 Magazine if you would prefer that instead with one of the books. 212-279-3400. We have three calls on the line. Let's see if we can build that up to an even five. You know, that would be nice. 212-279-3400. Let me just ask the two authors online. You've been on many other radio call-in shows, I guess, or talk shows of any sort. Is there anything special you'd like to say about non-commercial radio, its importance?
Well, I have to say, I think radio is terrific, especially non-commercial, because, first off, the hosts often really know a lot more about the story. They're the people who actually spend the time to read the books, to read the articles. I've been on a number of TV shows, and there are a lot of talking heads. They might have pretty faces, but they're pretty darn dumb. And I've enjoyed radio, and I think it's a great source of information.
I'll second that.
Yes. Fiber, you had something.
I wanted to say that earlier when you had mentioned the article that came out in July of 1994, I was actually in prison myself at the time, and I recall it coming out, and various inmates had asked me about it, and they asked me, what this person had done, Kevin Mitnick, if why all of a sudden out of the blue they were writing a story about him. And I thought it was quite odd myself, and really took me by surprise. But it was almost as if to say that, just in case you forgot, there's this Kevin Mitnick guy, and he's really dangerous, and We need to do something about them.
Yeah. Well, I think you also have to remember that, you know, at places like the New York Times, especially last, you know, the learning curve on this stuff is so fast, but last year, you know, so many people just don't understand how any of this stuff works, and they cannot judge for themselves who is dangerous and who is not. So you have a lot of very smart and intelligent people saying, trusting someone like John Markoff when he comes across someone like this, or if he suggests that Kevin Mitnick is a very frightening character. There aren't, or there haven't been until recently, very many people out there who can call him on that. It isn't like, you know, there's a lot of editors at the New York Times who understand what an IP spoof is. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And that's and because of that kind of ignorance, you see these kinds of stories. You see, you know, was seen as a sexy way to funnel all of this anxiety about technology we have. Here's finally a face we can name, you know. I mean, when this story broke, it was very interesting. Everyone was saying, oh, this is Bonnie and Clyde, you know, or Sherlock Holmes. It fit into this archetype. And now, if you look at the three books, I think you'll see that whole thing is really unraveling. And that was really a creation of the hype of the moment.
Yeah, you know, and I think I'd add that to Jeff is that now we're starting to see that Shimomura really, in some way, is quite a bit like Mitnick, that he has his own sort of dark past, that he has his own underlying motivations here, that his sole purpose wasn't to save the Internet, that we know that he was trying to get $500,000 a year from the NSA, and he was angry at the intelligence agency for not getting that.
I believe, Jeff, you asked Shimomura if he had hacked into systems in the past, and basically his answer was he didn't want to talk about it.
Right. He was clearly very, very uncomfortable with that question. And you know, Tsutomu, he doesn't do anything that he doesn't want to do. I mean, this is a guy who's very smart, very intelligent, and been sort of pampered all of his life because of that. He's got this kind of eccentric genius kind of rap that allows him to get away with a lot of things, and he just doesn't do what he doesn't want to do.
Well, I think he got away with a lot because of the kid glove treatment in the New York Times, and I think, actually, having looked at, to me, Jeff, the surprising thing in their story is he comes off terribly in their own story,
yeah.
In John Markoff's own words. He comes off as a guy that maligns his own assistant. This kid, who's a bright kid, who's trying to help him capture Mitnick, he's constantly maligning him. He misleads and lies to the FBI. He talks about taking a rock to some woman at the well who's trying to help him out. He comes off as an extremely arrogant person who has no respect for anyone or any form of law or authority.
And let me just say, I really, really wish that one of them were here now to address that issue. It's too bad we can't have a back and forth debate here. I don't want this to be a Markoff Shimomura bashing, but unfortunately there are so many questions that are left unanswered, and by not being here, unfortunately they will remain unanswered. 212-279-3400 is our phone number, and we have a brand new premium offer here, and this is designed for those of you who are not yet members of WBAI. Yes, we know you're out there, those people that listen every week and think that that's enough, that you can just listen and walk away and live your life in relative peace. Well, those days have come to an end, because we have something that even you will not be able to turn down. That's right, for a pledge of $50, you have to be a new member. This is for new members only. For a pledge of $50, you'll become a member of WBAI, and you will get one of the books, but we won't tell you which one. You see, that's part of the randomness of life. You don't know which book you're going to get, but you're going to get one of them. That much we can guarantee you. But you have to call now, 212-279-3400. That's in addition to the original pledges of $150, where you'll get all three books, or one of the books and a subscription to the magazine. 212-279-3400. We have two calls on the line, and we really should raise that up, because this is a one-time offer that is not going to be repeated past tonight. Also, a few people have been asking me, last show that we did 3 weeks ago, we said that if we got a hold of the president's Social Security number, we would be revealing that over the radio. Well, we have it. But, you know, I want to make sure people are out there. I want to make sure that there's support for this radio program, because you know, I don't want to be giving out vital information that, you know, that's only going to be heard by people that aren't really going to stand up for us in any way. 212-279-3400. 212-279-3400. Show your support for WBAI. Show your support for communication, for controversial issues. What these folks have done publishing these books, they've raised a lot of questions about a very controversial and timely topic. And that's what we all do here at WBAI, week after week, month after month, year after year. We've been doing it now for 30 years. And by questioning authority, by questioning the mainstream news, that's our purpose. That's the purpose of what Pacifica Radio is all about. And that's why we hope that you will support us and keep us going as a community radio station. 212-279-3400. If you've never pledged to WBAI before, it's a really simple process. You call us up. One of our volunteers will take your name and address. And if you want to give us a credit card, that's fine. That makes it easier for everybody, in fact. 212-279-3400. $50, any of the three books, $150, all three, and also a subscription to the magazine and one of the books if you prefer to do it that way. 212-279-3400. Two calls on the line. Joker, you have something.
Yeah, I think it's really funny that you comment on you know, Markov's involvement in what's going on and Tsutomu's